This is CliffCentral.com.
A question everybody is faced with at the moment is what the hell is happening with the ANC? And the name that keeps popping up, the name that has got everybody talking, is someone who should be more familiar to us after having been a cabinet minister under all four of our presidents post-democracy. And yet she is enigmatic. We're not entirely sure whose side she's on. We don't know very much about her personality. She's managed to remain very private in respect of much of her life and much of her opinion. Her name is Nkosazana Dlamini-Zuma. Well, someone was brave enough to take her on and discover as much as I think has been discovered hitherto about her. The book is called Woman in the Wings. It is written by Karine Duplessis, who joins me this morning. Subtitle here is Nkosazana Dlamini-Zuma and the Race for the Presidency. There are already people, friends of ours, Justice Malala, who are calling her out as a current loser in that battle. But who is this woman, Karine? How are you?
I'm good, thank you. And thank you for having me.
Sure. Well done on the book.
Yeah, thank you. It was a very quick work. Like you say, she's an enigma. And I spent about 3 months researching and writing the book, which is not a lot, people will tell you. And it was in between cabinet shuffles and reshuffles and stuff. So, I hope to have one day have more time to get behind what she's about.
It's by no means an authorized biography, right?
And it's not authorized. She refused to give me an interview. She didn't refuse to give me an interview.
She gave you the runaround.
Yeah, I just never requested one and here, there. And yeah, eventually the person that I was requesting it through said, rather not, you know. Because I guess the atmosphere is very charged ahead of the conference. It's not the best time to do a book like that in
Karine,
a way. Because nobody wanted to talk. They're all too scared to
Karine,
take sides.
Karine, this woman has not given much away over 25 years. And before that, even less. She doesn't like to be out there. She's not making herself available to the media. She makes herself available in very stage-managed situations where she knows the crowd, where she's got a scripted message.
Yeah, she's not charismatic either. And in a way, at the AU, we had a fair amount of access to her, which was nice. Over the past, I sort of made a point of, getting a ticket to go to Addis every January at least. And she always gave us some time. The South African journalists, I must add. The other journalists were all very unhappy about the fact that, she always made, I think we always had at least half an hour to an hour with her afterwards. And she explained to us what the AU is about and even shared some of her, how she felt about Addis and how she felt about being there. So, and in those times, I experienced her as quite warm. Not warm. She's a nice person, but she's a difficult person. And she's enigmatic. And also, in a way, I think the reason why a lot of people don't know much about her is that the last time she was really out there was Minister of Health. She was out there, foreign minister, she tended to be away a lot, did foreign stuff, which doesn't really concern
the average
journalists
person,
or the media here. And then in Home Affairs, she was out there quite a lot and doing tours, going on
Let's look at her past when she became known to us, because we can go further back later on. But I think for most South Africans, she was, this kind of forthright health minister in the beginning. She had very definite ideas about things like tobacco. She had ideas around public health care. And these were in the early years of the Mandela administration. And then later on with Thabo Mbeki, she became the foreign minister. And we always knew that she was very closely allied with him and with the Pahads and that sort of cabal of people back in those days, the 90s.
Yeah, they're the exile bunch.
Her record there is kind of up for review still, because some people say she did a great job as health minister and some people say she was terrible, but nobody seems to say, well, she was okay, which actually, if you balance it out, seems to be the only really reasonable conclusion to come to. She was okay.
Yeah, I think it was, the first government had a hard task after 94. I went back to the newspapers of that time and read about how polarized opinion was. And, even when she moved into her office there, it was kind of shabby and, you know, just like the old folks left it. Nobody made it nice or, you know, people had to build things up from the beginning. So I think President Mandela's first government, you know, when you assess it, you kind of have to look at it in that context.
And so let's be generous. And let's say she was a good Minister of Health for that period. And the public health service didn't exist for the majority of South Africans in the way that they wanted it to post-94. Yeah. It was certainly, there were two tiers. You know, you can criticize it and you can compliment it on a number of levels. But she obviously had to administer change in that period, which was very complicated and fraught. And who knows whether the record will show in the long term that she did any good or bad.
Yeah, I mean, the primary health care, you know, she established primary health care for mothers and children, which was good. The tobacco, interestingly enough now with the recent revelations about the funding.
Seems she might be funded by
or
tobacco.
Allegations, yeah, or if you not believe
even,
the Women's
Not even
League.
Big tobacco, but illegal tobacco, yeah. By, you know, which is almost worse.
Which is worse because there's no taxes.
Yeah.
The way she took on tobacco companies, the way she took on pricing of medicines, it was really brave to do. And I think it was really tough to stand up to those global international companies. But then also we had the Sarafina scandal where she gave a tender to a friend. There were some irregularities, big questions. Public Protector investigated it. President Mandela, interestingly enough, protected her throughout in Parliament from questions. So that was bad. I mean, the plus side, I guess, of that scandal is that she never repeated it in her time in government. There was never something of a similar magnitude. But then again, you know, some people say she should have been fired for that. So, yeah, so it's a mixed record, I guess.
Hey, listen, compared to some of the scandals we're looking at now, Sarafina's a drop in the ocean.
Yeah, 13 million it was at the time, which is, at the time, I guess, was also a lot of money, but it's...
Look, bad is bad. You can't say one bad is necessarily worse than another just because the amount's bigger. It's like saying, you know, comparing deaths in a tragedy to deaths in a tragedy.
Exactly.
For the people involved and their families, it's just horrific no matter what.
Indeed. But yeah, but I think she generally tries to play it clean. She's aware of how to play it clean more than some other politicians at the time or at the moment. but I also think she's ruthless. She's a politician. She would do a lot to, I mean, I guess maybe this takes us into the next topic, but she would do a lot to get into a position.
Now, that's exactly what you would do if you wanted to become chair of the AU, and ultimately something more important is to go into foreign affairs.
Exactly.
And at that stage, the Foreign Affairs Department was her and Aziz Pahada's deputy minister.
Yes.
And they were quite interventionist compared to our very lazy, almost dead Foreign Relations Department now. At that stage, they were part of the non-aligned movement. You know, we were pursuing actively diplomatic relations with pariah states like Iran. But we had a group of friends, a cluster of people who we associated with quite tightly. And otherwise, we were fairly open-minded in terms of our foreign policy. There was a foreign policy.
Yeah, we had a vision, at least. And we had, you know, President Thabo Mbeki had the vision of an African renaissance. And he was pursuing that throughout Africa, you know, traveling throughout Africa. And which is, I mean, different, like when we look at foreign relations now, then I kind of, every time that... this is perhaps a little bit biased, but every time President Zuma goes to a country, I wonder what, you know, how much money is in the plane with him and what his personal interests are. And it's a perception that might not be backed by entirely by facts, but there have been incidents where he's traveled. So in a way that, it was still a good era for us in foreign relations.
And Thabo Mbeki,
except although Zimbabwe was a bit
Thabo Mbeki, though, because he was as much an actor in the foreign affairs department as she was. In fact, in very many situations, she was his agent.
There's a lot of people who say, you know, sort of especially people who don't like her, who say that she was just basically doing his bidding.
But he trusted her.
And that is, yeah.
They went to university together. Yeah. They were in exile together for some time. She certainly had his ear. She was in his inner circle.
Yeah, and I think he knew she was intelligent, or she's intelligent enough to pull off those things, you know, to go there when she just got into the foreign affairs portfolio, which she didn't want, by the way. She cried bitterly and she ran home, and then afterwards she remembered to thank the president for deploying her. but she went on and she did her best. But when she just got in, there was the problem, the DRC problem, the war there, that, you know, she was shuttling to and from Pretoria to intervene, to help negotiate. To a large extent, she got credit for helping to establish peace in the DRC, for, you know, helping the elections, first elections, I can't remember what year, was it 2005? First elections in a long time. So in that sense, she has some of those kind of successes behind, you know, under her belt. And
I'm curious that you say she didn't want that portfolio. It almost makes me think that Thabo Mbeki was pushing her in a direction for her own personal growth, perhaps, and creating an aspiration, if there wasn't one already, for her to eventually take high political office here.
Yeah.
Perhaps, you know, in some way at that point, and who knows how history unfolds and whether these visions ever occurred to the people in question or not, but perhaps he thought of her as a kind of successor. And maybe he was grooming her for that by giving her foreign relations and then encouraging her to go to the AU, which was his and Obasanjo's pet project in some ways.
Yeah.
And saw her as taking an opportunity like that as a place and a way to show herself off as a diplomat, as a person of stature, as a potential statesperson.
Yeah, I mean, the foreign affairs portfolio in many countries, or even in South Africa, it's a high, very high-profile portfolio.
Although, you wouldn't think so looking at Maitin Kwana Mashabane, would you?
Yes, I wasn't going to be nasty, but you kind of, yeah, she hasn't really shone. But like you say, our foreign affairs really seems to kind of lack direction at the moment all over. And I'm not sure if it's because of Minister Nkwana Mashabane, or if she's just, you know, if President Zuma deployed her there because he wanted it to kind of just be a quiet portfolio. But in that time, foreign affairs was highly prestigious, and also because it was so close to President Mbeki. And even in 1999, there were reports of her wanting, or knowing that she's being set up to become president, knowing that she's being groomed, and wanting it.
That first female president thing started circulating around that time,
and
she was the runaway, you know, leader in the race at that
exactly
point.
Yeah, I mean,
even if there wasn't a race.
Yeah, and I think people forget that when they ask why is she doing what she's doing now. It's what, 20 years, almost 20 years now, that she's been wanting to be president, but every time she kind of has to step back, there's a man, you know, like President Mbeki wanted to serve a third term, and then you know, she got onto the wrong slate in 2007. And interestingly enough, she went onto Mbeki's slate in 2007 as deputy president, even though there was an offer from the Zuma slate as well.
But the Zuma slate
was a lower position.
And I was always curious about, we could get into the relationship with her ex-husband in a moment, but I was curious about how Phumzile Mlambo-Ngcuka was put ahead of her in that gap where we had a potential, you know, deputy president, it could have been a woman. Why Phumzile instead of her when she was Thabo Mbeki's favorite? It made me think that maybe they'd fallen out, or that he hadn't admired her work as much as he had before.
He wanted to. It was 2005 when then Deputy President Zuma was fired because of the Sheikh corruption case. And apparently he did offer her, or he did want to offer her, the position of deputy president. And then the story goes that, and I mean, this is the story as I heard it from other people, that the children begged with her not to, because it would look terrible. Their father's just been fired as deputy president, and then she steps into the position. So there was a lot of emotion around that at the time, and the children stepped in and said, please don't. And then she decided not to. Once again, I couldn't interview her. It's one thing I would love to ask her, is how did she feel about that?
So, Karine, at this point, because we can carry on with her political career in a second, at this point it might be worth just articulating clearly for people who are not sure. Nkosasana Dlamini-Zuma was the third wife of President Jacob Zuma.
There were
Makhumalo was the first. The second was the mother of Duduzane and Duduzile.
And possibly Edward, I think. She's
either the third or fourth, but she wasn't the first or second wife.
I'm just trying to think.
How many children did they have?
She was the second. They had four children. But yeah, he was already married when he got married to her in 1982. And she was already pregnant with the first child when they got married. And then they had four in quick succession. Within 10 years in the 1980s, she had four daughters with him. But she also brought up Edward Zuma, interestingly enough. Edward Zuma was, I think, Zuma's eldest child, and he was born with Maina Shongwe, who is the sister of a judge in the Labour Court judge. So that was their relationship, and they were together until 1998. They got divorced, but they were estranged before that already. They'd already been living apart.
What do you think was going on there? I mean, we can only surmise without having the principals in front of us to ask the questions. What do people tell you?
Yeah, there's a lot of speculation. The most likely, and it was also difficult to go into depth on or everything people said because of some confidentiality issues. And, you know, you sort of think if she didn't want the story to come out, is it right to expose her without her permission? But it seems there was animosity between the two. There was unhappiness about to put it nicely, he's polygamy. He had an affair with someone else.
Philandering. Well, all of this is on the public record now.
Yeah.
It's not as if you're gossiping.
I guess. Yeah, that's not gossip.
Yeah, this is probably the world's busiest man when it comes to busying himself with procreation and recreation.
Yeah, I think there was also a child born during that fight to another woman. So it was very... And I don't think she was entirely happily married when... I look at remarks that she made in interviews on marriage after that. There was something not incredibly, nice and fuzzy and warm about it.
Look, she's an intelligent woman. That goes without saying. She's certainly capable of doing a lot. She's not one of these disempowered, flirting, flitting, soft, vapid women who sometimes end up in these situations by their own or by the man's doing, usually the latter. So it would be hard to imagine that she would have just put up with this as a self-respecting human being who thought, you know, she might have her own political ambitions, which might pip his at some point. You don't want to be treated in a second-class way if you're a proud, upstanding person like that.
Yeah, I mean, she also had education. She's way more educated on paper than the president, President Zuma, than her ex-husband. I mean, she was a doctor. She has, two or three degrees at least in medicine. She's intelligent. I mean, her father pushed her to study hard at school. So you're right. And also she was his only legal wife, his only paper wife.
Western kind of marriage.
The only one that was married on paper.
On the basis of the actual law.
Yes.
Yeah, not an indigenous marriage.
Exactly.
But I'm curious also, you know, there's something else about her that makes me think that she's not the kind of person who would put up with being treated badly. I get the feeling that part of the reason she's so private is that she's extremely well endowed with self-control and an ability to project an image that she wishes for the public to have of her. In other words, she's not the kind of person who will do risky things or engage in relationships or situations that might come up to haunt her later on. She was certainly ambitious in that respect. And it appears to me someone of kind of incredible resolve and control, a proud woman.
Yeah, I mean, she's strong. She's very, I think it's a very good analysis, actually, that you just made. I mean, she's very strong. I mean, I don't think she's without her weaknesses or soft spots. But, I was trying to look, for instance, at whether she had another relationship after she divorced. And, you know, because all these scandals are coming out about Deputy President Cyril Ramaphosa. And, you know, it's much easier to kind of nail a woman with such scandals than perhaps a man in this, in our culture. But I couldn't find any. So I think she's very private, but also she's very strong. She keeps very clean. She keeps her image very clean.
Yeah.
She does
certainly
a lot to keep her
these revelations around her funders and her possible relationships with some very dodgy gangster type people. We'll leave that for later. What kind of a mother do you think she is? What did you discover there, if anything?
I think she's a very conflicted mother, a very, like I think many working mothers, she felt very inadequate because she couldn't be there for the children in the 90s. I mean, the children were very young. And she was even thinking of telling President Mandela, look, I don't want to be a minister because it takes me away from my children.
Oh, really?
So when she became a health minister, and that was one of the reasons she thought she was going to get a job in Durban with the Medical Research Council or like a local job and be there for the children. And then this ministerial thing came. And I think the kids were, they were all sort of born in the 80s, so they must have been like around 10 years old, thereabouts. And she felt bad about the fact that she was away from them. And I think her mother looked after the children at the time. And the kids, I mean, they asked her things like, why don't you come and pick us up from school? Hmm. Why aren't you here? And then she said to them, well, it's because, I'm a super mommy, or super mommies don't always have time to do that. But And that kind of guilt feelings of not being there for her children all the time, I think kind of found expression in the way she approached children, child health. She spoke a lot about that at the time, about how important it was for children to be healthy, to be well fed. So she poured her energies into that. And I mean, now I do think she's close to the children in the sense that she listens to them. Tutukile, the youngest, certainly has some kind of a hand in her campaign, in the social media campaign. And I do think if there is speculation still about President Zuma having an influence in her life, it might be via the children. That might be where she. If she does fall down, that could be a weak link for her, which is so unfair,
actually.
It's unfair because
it seems to be a redeeming quality for everyone else in the world. It's ironic that it should be her Achilles heel, if it is.
And you don't always have control over the children either, over what they do. So, although, I mean, I have four daughters, they're pretty intelligent from what I could gather, and strong and out there, and their own people as well. Not without problems, but they. So that's perhaps a sad. I sometimes wonder what she thinks when she's kind of alone there at home, and what she thinks about the children and her family life. It's not easy, I don't think.
Going back to her political career, before we head to the AU, she was Home Affairs Minister, and she's credited there for turning around that department quite well. It had its first clean audit in 16 years when she was minister. She appointed an excellent director general and really got Home Affairs back on track, because before that it was absolute chaos. I think she deserves some credit for that.
Yes, I think partly she deserves some credit, although there are people like Anamavusa Msimang was director general.
Right. He was the one who I think probably did the administration and the ops and the logistics around that turnaround, probably more hands-on than she was. But she gave him the political
leadership
that he needed. Yeah. So, I mean, credit is due. I'm trying to find, for those people who will defend her, I certainly don't want them saying, oh, you only looked at the nasty stuff.
Yeah. No, I mean, there's credit due to her, although on the other hand, she is getting a lot more credit than she deserves sometimes.
Oh.
Because her predecessor, Nosiviwe Mapisa-Ngakula, she started the process. The turnaround, the audit thing was, I think, definitely Dlamini Zuma. But there was a turnaround process at the same time where I think IDs, I mean, if you remember back at the time when you could wait months for an identity document to finish, now we wait, what, less than a week sometimes. And that process started under her predecessor, Nosiviwe Mapisa-Ngakula. But the turnaround, she appointed a very good accounting team for the turnaround, or for the audit, the getting the clean audit. And I spoke to some people who worked with her at the time. And this is something that could be to her credit if she does become a president as well. She knows how to appoint people around her that do the job. She doesn't always get on with them in the sense of, you know, they're not buddy-buddy, but she gets them in, they do the job, so they do it well.
Competence and merit.
And she knows how to spot it, even if she doesn't know. I mean, she might not be an accountant herself, but she would know how to spot somebody who can you know, get a clean audit.
Well, you see, this is something that I keep telling people who don't see a light at the end of the tunnel for her, because if she does win and she does prevail against all of these forces that are currently fighting for power in the ANC, then we've got to look for the reasons that she would succeed, because that's what we've got. And I really am digging deep here, because Home Affairs is the tiniest part of her history, but it was one that she emerged from relatively well. The African Union, not so much. I mean, first of all, Africa was pretty pissed off about the fact that we boldly put her forward, which was a sort of not done thing.
Yes, South Africa is a big country. Normally, small countries only would compete for that, for the position of African Union Commission Chair. And we just came in and put her up there and drove a very hard campaign. Also, she was competing against an incumbent who was due for a second term, Jean Ping. Mm. So basically we were saying, look, you're not doing a great job. We want our person in there. By all accounts, he wasn't doing a bad job. He probably wasn't great, but he wasn't doing a bad job. So we antagonized many people many countries when we boldly marched in there.
Took over.
And the first round of elections did not there was not a conclusive result. She didn't get the majority that she needed. And then it went on 6 months later, there was another round of elections. And then there was a lot of circumstance that played along as well. The people who were present, people who were campaigned, you know, it gave us 6 months more to campaign, to promise. There was money involved in some respects. And then she came, she kind of came in. Some people saw it as negative because they say, you know, it was a very divisive campaign. She barely made it. Whereas she said, look, you know, we got most of the countries there. We succeeded. But from that side, from that time onwards, there was animosity. South Africa, you know, we created some hostile feelings and also a lot of expectations. One of the big things that we were campaigning on as South Africa was that African solutions for African problems.
Right.
Africa must solve its own conflicts and the African Union must play a bigger role. And shortly after she came into power, I'm just trying to think which crisis it was now. I lose track. I think it was Mali or something. And France had to step in because the crisis, you know, none of the African forces could handle the crisis. And we actually ended up, or was it CAR now? But we ended up thanking France for stepping in there.
Well, CAR was also embarrassing.
Yeah.
And that happened under her watch.
Yeah. Then subsequently there were a lot of crises that happened under her watch.
And we still don't
have an African standby force.
And it was also a big divide between Anglophone and Francophone Africa about her and about the AU, which obviously crystallized into these crises and the different states' reactions to how to deal with them.
Yeah, that to an extent. I mean, the animosity between Anglophone and Francophone Africa is always there. I think it's been there before her time. But it just manifested again in the fight. Because France liked to intervene. The Francophone countries also don't have the same attitude as Anglophone or especially the Southern African states have about colonialism. They kind of like, okay, you know, fine, we were colonized, but there's not the this ideological opposition. Whereas, you know, especially South Africa and especially her, she feels very strongly about it. So, so I don't always think the Francophone countries understood her sort of drive at, you know, let's intervene, whereas they were fine with France perhaps coming in and helping them. And also, you know, the crises were just so bad that there was no way that the AU could intervene. I mean, one of the embarrassing things for me was the Boko Haram crisis, the kidnapping of the girls, which also happened during her time as AU Commission Chair. And I think at some point all the leaders went for some security summit in France. I can't remember the year now. But, yeah, so
it's probably 2013, 14.
It must have been around that time. But this bunch of girls disappear. You know, it's a gender issue in a way.
She was nowhere to be found.
And she was nowhere to be found. And
supposedly an issue close to her heart. You know, it's children. She's a mother. She's a woman. It's women. It's about, sovereignty in many situations, because we know the East and the West of Africa being ravaged by this very militant Islam, which people are concerned about, but the AU seems to be less concerned about. It is the most dangerous threat to most people living on those two sides of the continent.
They didn't seem to intervene as much as we would have thought them to, or as we would have expected, or
Cynical person would say she's more concerned about the West and ex-colonial powers interfering in Africa than she was about this militant terrorism, which seems to strike wherever it does, in Kenya as it did at the time, in Nigeria, CAR.
Yeah, that's one way of looking at it.
Even Mali.
Yeah.
I mean, all the crises, in fact, you could almost put a blanket over pretty much 90% of them and say, well, we know what the cause of these crises is, and it isn't Western ex-colonial powers coming back in to try and claim things. It's a very, very powerful and military spread of an ideology.
Yeah, I mean, in a way, if that's one of the things that, I mean, she tried to address, or her line was that she wanted to address the causes of the crises rather than just go and chase ambulances and put out fires all the time. So she drove this very, I was always reminded of Mbeki, you know, when everybody told him to go this way, he said, no, I'm sticking to my program and I'm driving this stubbornly. So she drove this developmental line at the AU, which she said, you know, if we have development, there won't be a need for these conflicts, or there won't be a appetite for these conflicts. So
that art of the possible stuff.
Yeah, I mean, it's this sort of idealistic, which, I mean, I think it's great. I think it's nice to have a different view on these things, although you can't drive that agenda in 4 or 5 years. You would need to stand for a second term to drive that agenda if you're really serious about it, which is, you know, why people are cynical in a way.
Yeah, because she only really occupied the office for as long as it was necessary for her to do something until she ran for president.
Yeah, I mean, and she also had this great... what's it? Agenda 2030, the UN one now?
Not sure.
Oh gosh, that was 2016. Anyway, but
what I'm curious
about.
Not
the name about. Now, but yeah, she set up this great long term vision program.
But didn't care to implement it.
I mean, it was nice. It really looked like she was doing things. She rallied support for it in the UN. There was great praise for it. Agenda 2063, that's the name.
Okay.
There was great praise for it, and it fitted in with the UN's programs, you know, their long-term sustainable development programs. So in that sense, she's very much a developmental, she's got the developmental approach rather than a putting out fires approach, which...
A lot of the criticism of her is from people who use similar words to the words that were used about Thabo Mbeki around Polokwane: aloof, stubborn... centrist, appoints people that she can trust, that kind of language. These are the things that got Thabo Mbeki fired, among others, obviously.
Yes.
Do you think that her default position as a leader, and perhaps even as a politician, is closer to his approach or closer to the approach of her ex-husband?
I would say closer to Mbeki, because there are many times when she speaks and she reminds me of him, you know, because she's not a great speaker in the sense of the content is engaging sometimes.
It doesn't connect.
But Yeah, well, yeah, that's another issue, especially her campaign speeches now sometimes. But yeah, connect in the sense of you sit there and you listen to her and you just want to fall asleep sometimes. Mm. Although, I mean, also depends on the audience. When she speaks to audiences in rural areas, I went to a meeting in Limpopo a while ago. It was actually quite engaging. It wasn't rousing. It's not like... I mean, President Zuma is great when he speaks to audiences in rural areas and he connects and he actually has a conversation with people and people would jump up in the middle of the speech and clap and sing. And it's not that kind of circus. But yeah, I mean, she says things that people want to hear. And so in that sense, but I do think she's closer to Mbeki, more like a technocrat, you know, cares to get the small print right. I'm sure she's read the Constitution, unlike some other presidents that we have at the moment. I mean, ironically, the things that Mbeki was fired for was not really the things that he was fired for, as all of us know. But so I'm not sure if her style of government really would be a problem to the people who are campaigning for her now. But yeah, but I would say it's closer to Mbeki's.
She's obviously been embroiled in a few controversies in this run-up to her presidential campaign and even in the campaign. Before Bell Pottinger were outed as the agents of white monopoly capital myths. And certainly, you know, it's got enough truth in it that it sounds like it might be a possibility. But we now know that that was a coordinated and manufactured campaign, that the entire idea of white monopoly capital was one that was very artificially and cleverly put together in order to create a result, which it did. Problem is they were found out. But before they were found out, she seemed only too happy to ride on that bandwagon. And for a while, her choice topics were white monopoly capital, land, white privilege, that kind of thing. Not that different to the BLF or even the EFF.
Yes, indeed. Yeah, and I mean, that's the strange thing to me, or the thing that I'm sort of, I think a lot of, well, all of us are trying to understand is, how can a woman like that with, you know, she seems to have strong values. She's got some good, record of clean governance and so on. How could she ride on a bandwagon that includes people like the Social Development Minister, Basabile Dlamini, that includes Bell Pottinger, that includes MKMVA's dodgy lot, the ANC Youth League, you know, with all their claims.
It's such a coalition of the wounded and the desperate.
Yeah, and it is strange. I mean, but in a way, she rides on that bandwagon, but she kind of never seems to become quite part of it either.
Maybe she's afraid of populism. Maybe she doesn't understand populism. Maybe as a result, she tries to give overture to it. And, you know, almost sort of throws a bone to the left to try and prove to them that she's not going to be Thabo Mbeki 2.0. Do you think that might be it? Because her husband has such a grasp of it. He has such an understanding of how to... Look, to him, he doesn't care. He's probably the arch-capitalist of all capitalists, but he's good at selling. He's good at selling the message.
Yeah, because the idea I get is that she's trying to do whatever it takes to become president.
Yeah. Almost like Hillary Clinton tried whatever it took to become president in America.
Yeah, in a way. And
but we get a similar feeling of inauthentic behavior. Like neither of them particularly charismatic.
Yeah.
Neither of them particularly warm.
No.
But neither of them embodying any of those powerful characteristics that women could use not only to win over other women, but men.
Yeah, I mean, because that's the point I wanted to make. I mean, they're both women. They're both competing in a male game, really, which is what, you know, we've had male presidents. And, you know, by the sound of it, from I've spoken to people in the provinces where she's supposed to be strong, the rural provinces especially, the patriarchy is still very, very big. Some men even said, we don't want a woman to come and address our meeting. So that's the kind of stuff she's up against. And somehow, I'm not sure if she's not found her style completely. I mean, also, would somebody like her, you know, in this day and age, would somebody who's not populist really become a leader? So So yes, yeah, so I kind of think she calculated this to ride on that bandwagon that kind of pushes the populism.
But it hasn't worked so well. I mean, it seems to me that KZN would rather carry on internecine fighting than back her outright. There are two very, very different factions there that are battling for power. And the fact that Cyril Ramaphosa even had, or anyone else, Swelim Kizo, anyone else, would even have had a toehold there was unquestionable. It was impossible before. Now, yeah, it seems almost a foregone conclusion that there's going to be some kind of ugliness in KZN, and that whatever delegates are dispatched in December to that conference, there will be massive disagreement between those people. So that's not a foregone conclusion, which we were almost sure it would be for her. KZN was in the bag.
I think she still got KZN, but I mean, the percentages there...
She certainly didn't earn it. It's almost as if she's thrown away some of that political capital that she might have had.
Yeah, I mean, she did a lot of work on the ground to talk to branches. And I think this is one of the things that sometimes it's difficult to understand when we, for instance, sit in Johannesburg and look at the race. Things that appeal to us don't necessarily appeal to people on the ground in a rural area where, you know, if you go there, people live differently. They might not have running water in the house. You know, they live next to a big mountain and have a big superstition about this mountain. So people think about life and politics in a different way. And in a sense, I mean, yeah, there's a big Zuma fatigue amongst a lot of members. But in a sense, this cleverly crafted campaign of radical economic transformation is finding some ground. And so, yeah, and she did a lot of work in branches. She goes there, talks to people. She's a very different person
than she is when she's with
a business crowd.
She's smart enough to win over that. That's almost like a home ground advantage, is the smart people. You know, the urban middle classes, you would think would be rallying to her cause. Because she could speak their language.
How many of them are going to the ANC conference?
Well, that's a good point.
But then,
is she dumbing down, or is she? You said she'll do anything to be president. Does that include changing her position on important things that she intellectually couldn't possibly support?
I don't think.
Because then that'll end up like Hillary. People won't know what she stands for.
Yeah. That's a good question.
I don't think rural people are stupid.
They're not stupid, but...
they can tell when they've got honesty or when they've got lies.
I don't think she's lying to them. I mean, the radical economic transformation, what she's saying, I've heard her and Cyril Ramaphosa talk about it. They're essentially saying the same thing with different words. She's not placing as much emphasis as he is on anti-corruption, but you can't really eat anti-corruption. So,
no.
I mean, in a way... Yeah, I think her campaign is clever enough to win her votes at the ANC's conference.
But she's hired a lot of people who did her no favors on this campaign. She hasn't really put together the strongest team.
No, she hasn't.
And she's been good at that before. So maybe she's self-sabotaging. I mean, I'm throwing in every possible theory here, but it doesn't seem to me like... There's this drive.
Oh, you think she wants to not become president?
Well, I don't know, because certainly it appears on paper as if she really wants this. And you rightly say she looks like she'll do anything for it. But I can't help thinking that she also feels a little bit used, that she would be the vehicle for keeping whatever power is in place at the moment in place.
Yeah.
And perhaps she finds that...
She's uncomfortable.
Disconcerting.
With it all.
I mean, this is an independent thinker. She believes in a woman's freedom, right to choose, ability to be her own agent, that kind of thing. And yet she finds herself being moved around the chessboard some of the time. It must be an interesting conundrum for someone who's smart enough to see it happening.
Yeah, and I mean,
does she maybe have the capacity to pivot once she's in position?
That's the big question. That once she is there, will she get rid of all these people around her who are not useful to her anymore? I don't know. I mean, she's If you look at people she's worked with a long time, you know, she's certainly got like Phoebe Potgieter-Kabule, who's sort of quietly coordinating a lot of the campaign. She's worked with her since Foreign Affairs. So there's people that she's worked with a long time, and then other people that she, you know, like Mavuso Msimang, she didn't get on with him, and he left pretty quickly. But I'm trying to think of instances now where she got rid of people that she couldn't work with. I mean, in the AU, for instance, there's this talk that some of the countries didn't like her because she got rid of people who were working in the AU as consultants. They were pensioners already, or they were on pension already, but they came back as consultants at massive costs. She got rid of them. So she's not scared to get rid of people, but whether she would get rid of these people, it's a tough question. And, you know, to a big extent, if she or if any ANC president tries to tackle corruption, they might just find the whole edifice crumbling. You know, if you get rid of everybody who's corrupt in the party,
there's no one left.
not quite that, but I mean a lot of because of the patronage networks that are so entrenched at the moment. It's crazy because I was in Mpumalanga over the weekend and somebody told me some of the members want Cyril Ramaphosa, but the leaders of the branches, the branch chairpersons, are all either councillors or they work in the civil service, and which means that they pay some, or say they have some kind of allegiance to the premier, to Di Mambuza, in some way. You know, they benefit from that income.
So, in other words, whichever way he blows, they'll have to go with him.
Yeah.
And he's been playing a bit of a kingmaker game lately.
Yes.
He's promising both camps whatever they want in order to get whatever he wants.
Yes. I mean, I think he's kind of loyal to both camps as well on a personal level, but he's also loyal to neither. So.
He's loyal to him.
But the point I was trying to make is that, wasn't trying to talk about Didi Mabuza here, is that so much of the ANC is built on that now. And, you know, President Mbeki also warned, he said, I warned you against using the ANC to get to power.
This is why it's
crumbling. So how do you dismantle this without, and win an election in 2019?
Look, whoever wins in December, whether it's Cyril, Zweli, Kwasasana, or some other shadow candidate we don't even know about, they've got all their work ahead of them. This campaign is the easiest part of what they're going to have to achieve in the next 5 years.
Yeah. And but it's also the unusual part. I was going to, you know, when you said about the people managing her campaign, it's the first time that we've seen presidential candidates campaign like this. I mean, in 2007, then ANC was chairperson. And if you remember Mosiwa Lekota, how he was throwing a tantrum about T-shirts with faces on them of Zuma. And I mean, then it was a no-no to campaign like this. So this campaign itself is very new. So
only a little bit of time left. First of all, her ex-husband, the current president, is she his preferred candidate, or is he just posturing? Because we hear from Bantu Holomisa, no, the real candidate's Zweli Mkhize. Does the president care whether it's either of those? Does he believe that she will try and keep him out of jail if she becomes president? These are the hard questions.
Yeah, they're the hard questions. Although, I mean, I was sitting there thinking the other day, would Cyril Ramaphosa be able to even, or Zweli Mkhize be able to jail President Zuma if they become president? So, you know, that's the other side. So, but, I mean, I think he believes it's a tough question, but I do think he believes he can continue a lot of the patronage networks through her, or try to continue the patronage networks through her, or through some kind of a family network. But whether she would fall for that, or whether she would stand for that, that's a different question. I would like to believe that she would be cautious. I mean, the interesting thing is, I went to her hometown where she was born, near Bulwer. And one of the guys in the community said there she's renovating her old house there and sort of making it a bit bigger. But she went to a meeting with the community leaders and she spoke about it, told them about her plans. And she says, guys, I don't want another Nkandla here. So she knows about that, you know, ostentatious wealth. She knows about not appearing corrupt. So she would certainly be more cautious about appearances than you know, President Zuma would.
What kind of personality does she have, if any? Because I can't imagine she's just this monolithic. What makes her laugh? Do we know anything about her?
I'm trying to think. We had interviews and she laughed during those interviews.
What makes her laugh? Can you remember?
I'm trying to remember now. We were talking about her time in Ethiopia, whether she enjoyed Addis Ababa. And you know, we talked about food and you know, she said she liked the sourdough, the injera there reminded her of, I think it's ting that Sotho people or Tswana people eat, which is a sourdough pap or something.
Mm-hmm.
So we were talking about that and, you know, and with that she spoke with expression on her face and with interest. And I think she does like to entertain. I heard that she likes to entertain people, to eat with people. So I mean, and she's warm. I mean, people who've worked with her say that they like her. She's approachable. She works well. But if she doesn't like you, you know, she can be very stubborn. She can be very curt. And it's strange that people either love her or they hate her. That people that she's worked with. So I certainly think she's no nonsense, stubborn. Enigmatic. That would be.
But two last things.
Makes her laugh, yeah, that's a good.
There are two things I want to ask you. The first one is, do you think that she's read your book? She certainly knows about it by now.
Yeah. I've spoken to the PR people that are around her. I mean, she certainly knows about the book. I do think somebody said they were in a hotel just when my book came out and they saw her sitting there with a book.
Okay.
So I do think she's aware of what's in it. I haven't heard anything because I was a bit nervous. I mean, there were some things that I wasn't sure about and I couldn't go to her and say, look, was it this way or was it that way? Did you cross through Botswana or did you cross through, you know, wherever when you went into exile? I couldn't ask her that. But there's been no bad comeback and I have not been trolled on social media yet.
By the Gupta bots?
By the Gupta bots or anything, for anything I said in the book. And perhaps, I mean, I don't think it's that controversial. They're not, you know, I didn't have enough time to dig into things that might have been controversial. And my aim was more to put together a book about her life, to say, well, this is the woman, than it was to expose anything, which might be, you know, a different kind of book altogether.
And this is a horrible thing to ask a journalist, especially one of your experience and repute, but do you like her?
Yes, I actually do. I like her. I'm a feminist. I like her resolve as a woman.
You're not one of those feminists who will just support a woman because she's a woman.
I might be, actually.
that's kind of like a racist who would support any white person just because they're white.
Yeah, no, that's a loaded question. I would not. I mean, in Germany, who was that woman candidate? I forgot her name again. Gosh, my brain's not working today. But yeah, I wouldn't support a woman just because she's a woman. But what I like about her is, I mean, she did a lot to get to where she is now, against the odds, despite being a woman, despite being a black person in South Africa at that time. So I do like her. And she went to great extent to get an education, you know, to learn, to push ahead, had four children, pushed ahead in exile with four children. She's a strong woman, and I admire that. But I'm very aware of the fact that she's a politician and you know, she's not a messiah.
Well, certainly not if she's being funded by illicit tobacco.
No.
But we'll leave that stuff for the next investigation. Thank you for your book and congratulations on it. It's called Woman in the Wings. It's by Karine Duplessis, who's our guest, and Nkosa Sana Dlamini Zuma and the Race for the Presidency. It's available in Penguin Books. It's worth checking out if you care about what might happen in December, and I suppose we all should. Thank you, Karine.
Thank you so much for having me, Gareth.
This is CliffCentral.com.